Good morning and welcome to another exciting edition of Blogging Heads. I am one of your two hosts, Ezra Klein from the American Prospect, and I'm here with...
Ramesh Panero of National Review.
How you doing, Ramesh?
Good, how are you?
I'm not bad. So even as we speak, in a small room somewhere, I think in the Capitol, but I'm not sure about that, a crew of hand-chosen reporters are studying John McCain's age records. Or not age records, his health records, I'm sorry. And I don't know if you've been following the story very much, but as a way to tamp down on questions of age, he's sort of opening up 400 pages of medical records to a small group of chosen media outlets who can send only a couple reporters each or one reporter each, and they're given a couple hours to look through all these documents and data and try to figure out if McCain is up to the job. And I got to say, I want to talk about age in a second a little bit more generally.
Sure.
But I think this sort of thing is actually pretty poisonous. I mean, forgetting the fact that, you know, if you're going to do this, do it right. You should have doctors looking at this, not reporters, and you should have, you know, not be doing it on the day before Labor Day, the Friday before Labor Day. But, you know, if it were up to me, what you would have is a sort of chief doctor of the White House medical team would evaluate the records and give a physical to the contenders. And if there was something that was required for disclosure, it would be disclosed by them. But I think this sort of... more ad hoc process in which people try to figure out and speculate what the health outlook is like is a problem, because if you're really going to be concerned with mortality, there's a lot you have to be concerned with. I mean, you know, Barack Obama's mother died from cancer very young. I mean, so he's probably got a high probability or higher than some would for that. You know, you have to worry about assassination and will they travel. And I tend to think that that's really ground we don't want to till, but I'd be interested for your take on it.
Well, first of all, this is the Friday before Memorial Day, and I think that your calling it Labor Day reflects typical liberal alienation from the American military and support for socialized unionism. But leaving that aside, no, I think that there is something almost sort of, the notion of the U.S. president is elected king comes into play here, that, you know, there's, well, oh, you know, we have to be careful about every little health possible problem that that a president might have, you know, even though we actually do have a vice king, you know, in our system. I mean, it's not like the country would just fall apart if the new president were to have some sort of health problems. But I do think in the sort of modern political environment, this sort of thing is absolutely inescapable. Just like Cindy McCain is going to have to release those tax records eventually. I mean, I think in a way it's a more reasonable argument in that case that she should do it. But either way, these things just have to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I would separate the tax argument out, but I guess here'd be a secondary point on it, right, to get a little bit more directly into the age question.
Yeah.
I feel like we talk about the medical history as an actual proxy for age, right? I mean, we're not really evaluating much in the way of medical history. Obviously, somebody, you know, if metastatic breast cancer weren't a disqualification, I would run the draft Elizabeth Edwards campaign myself. But, you know, so there are things that we agree. I mean, because of the sort of level of treatment you're going to need, you wouldn't be able to carry out the duties of the office. But in general, I think that we're using it as a proxy for age. McCain's people are using it as a proxy for age. Oh, look, he's healthy. Oh, look, his mother is 102 or whatever.
Right.
And
a little bit less than that, but yeah.
I actually would like to see a conversation about age in this respect. Not that one. I don't want to have this sort of conversation over health. Because then you essentially put in this place where they say, the doctor says, oh, he's the most vigorous 71-year-old I've ever met. And then somebody else looks at a mortality table and says, oh, no, but he's got a 15% chance of dying. And I don't think that's actually a productive conversation. I think age is interesting, though. You know, I don't know if you know this, but Obama and McCain have the largest age difference of any two presidential candidates ever.
That does not surprise me, but yeah, I hadn't actually heard that.
And, you know, their worldviews really are informed in different ways by how old they are. I mean, you know, it's sort of been dramatized a little bit by that website, Things That Are Younger Than John McCain, which has, like, among the offerings, chocolate chip cookies and Cobb salad and Mount Rushmore. But, you know, John McCain is sort of in this pre-Vietnam era, the post-World War II era, and his worldview, it seems to me, is very, very, very heavily shot through with that, with the belief that we do have, as he puts it, transcendent challenges and enemies, really existential threats, and the belief that, you know, the country, the greatest honor, the greatest purpose of the country is to be sort of broadly mobilized towards mm-hmm. a greater goal, an enemy that can be triumphed over or some challenge that can be overcome. And I think, conversely, you see a sort of interesting effect in the Obama campaign where he has a tendency to react to certain political arguments with, like, a degree of apparent confusion. Like, it's very clear he thinks William Ayer's stuff is stupid, as do I. But he thinks that because he just wasn't conscious in 68.
Both of these candidates missed the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Say what?
Both of these candidates missed the 60s for different reasons.
Right, for different reasons, which is interesting, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. you actually have McCain as pre and Obama as post, but you don't have... They're not fighting over the 60s, really. They're fighting over sort of two conceptions. And Obama is of this conception where the United States really doesn't have huge, broad-scale enemies so much as they have, but, you know, almost like a mop-up operation on terrorism. And McCain from quite the opposite. And I think that I would actually like to see that people be willing to discuss that, honestly. And I feel like all the talk of age as a health issue rather than age as a sort of cohort and judgment issue is sort of distracting from that.
Well, and also, I mean, part of the problem with having a candid and honest conversation about the age issue is that there are people feel slightly guilty about bringing it up in a political context. I mean, the late night comedians have no problem at all bringing it up, which is one of the reasons it's potentially so damaging to McCain. But if the Democrats bring it up, they're going to do it, you know, while pretending that they're not bringing it up at all. And so, you know, obviously under those conditions, it becomes impossible to talk about what you want to talk about. I think Howard Dean came close a few weeks ago when he talked about McCain being, you know, from the 1940s. But he had previously said that we're not going to raise his age because there's an ethical bar to doing so. And so, you know, once you've said something like that, it becomes very hard to go back and try to do it in some sort of clever way.
Right, I agree with that, and I think you're right that Democrats are trying to do it in a sort of vaguely subterranean way. I mean, when Obama says this is an argument between the past and the future,
right?
I agree with that, but it is certainly an argument that works on both levels, and I think it ends up being actually a little bit more of a cheap shot because they're not, you know, dealing with it forthrightly than it would be if you just said it's an argument between the past and the future because sort of. You know, I come from a generation, speaking as Obama, as I often try to do at cocktail parties, I come from a generation that has never been red-baited, that does not sort of see things in USSR terms, that, you know, conceives of really, really sort of on a gut level gets that America faces challenges and threats, but not challenges to its existence or continuation. Hmm. And where McCain, I think there is sort of an immediacy to the threat we could face. And, you know, and I think arguments can be made on both sides. I mean, nuclear, you know, obviously the spread of nuclear weapons and the possibility of one falling to the hands of a terrorist, you know, creates a bit of, you know, it isn't just like the terrorists are a bunch of people with, you know, suicide belts and AK-47s. So, but I feel like that argument could be had. And it's a weird one that they sort of are having. But they're not being honest about it, I feel.
Well,
you know, McCain does believe in the size of the threat. And I mean, Obama does have a different conception of that. And I think that, you know, this sort of, a lot of that really is informed by their generations. And, yeah, I don't know how you would bring that up politically.
Well,
as far as the press is going to be talking about it, I really would prefer they weren't talking about medical records and instead talking about, you know, this sort of thing.
Well, the thing is, I think that the age question works against McCain to the extent that it's a health question, and to the extent that it's a generally speaking past versus future question. But if you were to actually talk about sort of a World War II era worldview and so forth, I'm not sure that would be such a bad contrast for McCain. I mean, I think that, so to speak, the World War II worldview would pull pretty well, actually. And so I think that's another reason why we're not going to have the sort of debate that you seem to want us to have. But it's also another reason why, you know, as long as McCain shows mental sharpness and vigor and a future-oriented agenda, I think he'll be, you know, he'll be able to defuse the age issue. I mean, that was what was I mean, what was so deadly about Bob Dole in 1996 was not only that he was actually slightly older than McCain is now, but just that everything he did seemed so old. And, of course, falling off the stage during the campaign is not helpful. I guess it's never really helpful to fall off the stage.
Putting aside, you know, the possibility of health catastrophe for either, I sort of agree with that, actually. I think the danger for McCain in the age issue is actually a falling off the stage moment. Mm-hmm. Like, he's tired one day on an interview and has what looks like on camera a senior moment. I mean, I think what his campaign, and this is just a tough thing, is going to have to be on guard for every day, is the visual.
Yeah, because he can't do the 57 states thing that Obama did, right? I mean,
the what?
Oh, remember when Obama was tired at one of his appearances and he said something about having been to all 57 states?
Right, yeah.
I mean, McCain just could not do something like that because...
Although, frankly, I feel like... I mean, in some ways, right? He has done a couple things where he's misspoken and it's been okay. I almost think that would have to be much more like... It would be a question of the demeanor he had on camera than if he just...
Yeah.
If he confidently said that Iran was training al-Qaeda, people are just like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But if he looked confused about it, that would be a very different thing. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think the comportment is important there.
In our visual culture, thanks brought to us in part by your generation.
And here on Blogging Heads, right? I mean, there was a time when we were all just writing, but now if I forget what I'm talking about, people can all tell.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to have to invest money in, you know, makeup and a new wardrobe and so forth to be on the screen more.
It's true. So why don't we move then from age for a second
sure.
and talk about the destruction and death and idea exhaustion of your movement.
Okay.
The New Yorker this week. Did you read, this is a for people in the audience, audience out there that I can't see and must trust will actually be watching. This is a George Packer article on have conservatives run out of ideas. And Ramesh, you read it?
I made a really good college try, and toward the last third, I just started skimming. But yes, I did read most of it. It seemed like he just sort of threw in every idea he had about the past, present, and future of conservatism into an article and sort of, you know, just sort of put it in a bag and shook it all up, and saw what came out. But yeah, I did read it. And I trusted you. A lot of people have been commenting on it on the blogs. I was on vacation, so I haven't actually read much of the blog commentary about it, but I noticed that it existed.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, if you don't mind my just launching into it, I thought it was very...
No, I want you to.
For one thing, the history he tells of conservatism is... idiosyncratic, right? I mean, most people would sort of go, I mean, certainly the movement itself tells the story sort of from National Review to Goldwater to Reagan, and he starts it with sort of Nixon and relies on Buchanan a lot, and actually talks more about sort of the Nixon election than he does about either Goldwater or Reagan. And I think that's a defensible choice. It's just that he doesn't actually defend it, right? I mean, he doesn't actually sort of explain why we should take this view. And in fact, he has these sort of discordant notes every once in a while where you're like, you can't say, oh, well, by the way, Nixon wasn't actually a Reaganite conservative, and he built on the Great Society. And, you know, and he sort of just registers these things, but he doesn't, you know, sort of assimilate them. And then he sort of goes on... I think he's basically right, though. I mean, moving away from the history, when he talks about sort of there being conservatives who think reason conservatives and Republicans are in bad shape right now is they have sort of departed from the true path, and all they have to do is really get serious about cutting federal spending and sort of returning to the good old-fashioned conservative program, and everything will be right again. And then there are people who think, no, that's not the case, that in fact conservatism has not done a good job of adapting to current circumstances and the sort of the contemporary American condition. That's what needs to be done. I don't think he's quite as good in talking about sort of what the people in that second camp tend to believe. You know, there are certainly some disagreements there. I mean, for example, I mean, he groups David Frum, Ross Douthat, to a certain extent, Yuval Levin and me, all in that camp of sort of reformers. And he says, well, you know, none of them really have proposals that are adequate to dealing with the problem of economic inequality. And, you know, this is just in most of us, I mean, David Frum being an exception, and I guess Jim Manzi, who writes for National Review, being another, most of us don't tend to think of economic inequality as a great pressing concern that that conservatism has to adapt to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, it's, in a way, as given that most sort of actual conservatives aren't paying tons of attention to this debate, I can't really fault an outsider for not being attentive to its every nuance.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there were a couple. I thought the article was interesting, of course, and certainly it warmed my heart. But I thought there were two problems. One was a sort of, and you get this a lot in journalism, I think, was a focus on political actors and not political economy, right? I mean, the conservative movement is a lot of things. One of them is ideas and policy proposals. But, you know, if you're going to be talking about them and talking about the exhaustion of the movement, but you're not talking about the sort of what do its sort of key constituencies want. I mean, Ross Douthat is like a friend of mine. He's somebody I see at parties sometimes. And, like, it's really weird for me to think of, like, an article about, like, the future of the Republican Party hinging on his new book. And maybe it does. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And I think his book is going to be great. And I think he's certainly a brilliant guy. But there's a sort of, I felt...
It's a little too ethereal a discussion.
Ideas, actually. Yeah. The other thing about it was that I sort of, you know, I'm young, but not so young that I wasn't around 2.5 years ago when Democrats had, you know, lost the 2004 election a little while back. And,
right.
You know, we were said to be Democrats were said to be out, not only out of ideas, but, like, needed real help understanding cognitive linguistics and also needed to become much, much more religious. And then, you know, a couple of years later, the shoe's on the other foot. And, you know, I think that what has changed... It's not like the past 2 years have been a period of really remarkable idea generation on the Democratic side. And more to the point, the ideas being offered certainly are, you know, if anything, they're more sort of full-throated versions of our old ideas, like universal health care and a more progressive taxation structure and on and on. I think that what changed are the problems. And I think that conservatism's movement right now is when the problems were... In 2004, when they were able to seem like they were, you know, the need to project American strength in recognition and response to a sort of attack on our shores and a war going on abroad.
Right.
Conservatives had a lot of, neocons had, you know, pretty good ideas for that. Good ideas being the wrong word, but ideas that seemed responsive to that concern. And, you know, also when people sort of felt at the same time, you know, when they felt anxious about things at home and began feeling anxious about, or things abroad and began feeling anxious about change at home, and you sort of had this cultural moment in the 2004 elections when gay marriage was a big issue, and so on and so forth. But now when the problem is people feel government needs to be working and isn't, when they feel that the Iraq war is failing and needs to be brought to some sort of a close, when they feel that... You know, gas prices are up and economic anxiety is up and, you know, healthcare is getting more and more expensive and more insecure. I feel like you've had, what you really had is not a change in ideas of conservatives, but a change towards problems that liberals are well suited to dealing with. And, you know, if things went back to crime and drugs, suddenly conservatives would have a lot more ideas. But just, it wouldn't be that they'd have a lot more ideas. It would be that the ideas that they already have are salient again.
I think there's something to that. Let me go back to the first part of what you were just saying there, though. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party has changed over the last decade, at least in its tone, possibly in part because of the issue mix, but also because of a conscious set of decisions by Democrats to adapt to political circumstances. I think there's much less emphasis than there used to be on socially liberal positions and much more of an emphasis on economic issues, and not just more emphasis on them, but a slightly different set of positions on them. I mean, there's much more movement towards, fair trade on trade policy, for example. And there's a more robust set of healthcare proposals than you've had since the mid-1990s and the collapse of the original Clinton-Care initiative. So, I mean, there have been a set of changes, and you're right in a way that it's not a huge sort of reorientation of the party, in that, you know, the platform would have to be radically different from what it was in, say, 2000. And I'm not sure those of us who are agitating for a similar redefinition of the Republican Party are envisioning a platform that would look all that different, as opposed to the same impulses given new articulation, new instantiations, and new emphases. I take your point about sort of problems conservatism or sort of conservatives as they actually exist are equipped to take on, and those that liberals are equipped to take on. I mean, this actually sort of brings back to mind the old Samuel Huntington definition of conservatism from I guess it was the late 50s, where he said, you know, that conservatism is all about the defense of embattled institutions. It's, mm-hmm. A strange beast that slumbers through the summer and only awakens in the wintertime. The only thing I would say is that it's not so much that conservatism can't, in sort of in theory and in principle, talk about certain institutions like, you know, trust in American government, having a functioning healthcare system, as being sort of part of American life, that we could come to the defense of what works in those institutions. It's just that, you know, we're not in the habit of doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't given much thought. I mean, as you and I both write a fair amount about healthcare policy, but you have a lot more competition on the left among journalists who write about that than I do on the right.
That I think may be true. I mean, this is a good sort of segue into talking about healthcare, which, thank God, finally. But, I think it is interesting in that. You know, so you wrote this piece on the Wyden-Bennett plan, right? And the Wyden-Bennett plan, for our fascinated audience who's waiting for us to get into the details of healthcare legislation, is a sort of, you know, this bipartisan plan in the Senate. It's got, I think, now 14 or 16 senators, 7 or 8 Republicans, 7 or 8 Democrats on it. And, you know, what it attempts to do, essentially, is create universal coverage that's regulated by the government but managed by private insurers. And I think you pointed out, and I agree with this actually, that what it does is it turns private insurers into publicly regulated utilities. It is single payer contracted out,
right,
to private companies, which is why I like it. But, you know, you wrote in towards the end of the article this sort of thing about the McCain plan, like, oh, you know, finally Republicans do have a popular alternative. And, you know, I would think actually the Bennett plan is the sort of thing that Republicans would come around on. To some degree it has real government involvement, but it also for now creates a market in which one could imagine private insurers being able to compete on cost and quality and care management and blah, 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 blah. What I really can't see happening, is the John McCain sort of Ramesh Panuru, et cetera, Michael Cannon vision of in a polity where the people are saying, what worries us about healthcare is our risk and financial vulnerability. Having a party come to them and say, you know what's the problem with your healthcare? You are not financially vulnerable enough, and you are not risk-averse enough, and we're going to make both things more so. And it's not that I don't understand the theory behind sort of
right. The
conservative moral hazard argument that if people are paying for more of their care and we're sort of more...
You just don't think it's a winner.
...make better decisions. I mean, I think it's wrong for... I mean, I'd make a policy argument against
right.
it being that I don't think people are equipped to make those decisions, but I would make a political argument that I just find it, like, a little bit baffling, actually. It's one thing, I think, to say maybe we can sneak it in there, but to say it'll be politically popular, I really sort of wonder how you think that one's going to go.
Sure. If you wouldn't mind just backing up a step, I'm just interested in your thought on this question. Do you actually think that there's a policy merit as opposed to a political merit to contracting out, as you say, single payer as opposed to just doing single payer? Or do you see the advantages mostly just political?
I mean, I actually think there are dual arguments. For one is that I can't think of any time when we've signed out of existence a multi-billion-dollar industry that provides tens of thousands of jobs in this country. I mean, I think you know, I don't know if it's quite like the biblical line, private insurers you shall have with you always, mm-hmm. but it ain't that far at the moment. But I actually think there's a policy argument for it, and here's what it is. That if you take this sort of Ezra Klein liberal critique of conservative healthcare seriously, and I being Ezra Klein do, and you think that it is hard for individuals to navigate the healthcare system, and I really believe it is. I think that there's a ton that they don't know. I think that the incentives within the system are, you know, are tricky. Individual doctors are not always best equipped to be guides to the whole thing, and maybe they could be. I think that there is some, there's a real utility for this sort of mediating position, something in between me and the hospital. Now, some would say that should be the doctor, but I sort of conceive of the doctor also, you know, within that complex, and oftentimes he is, unless you're going to change the system and really reorient towards primary care, which I guess you could do too. Right now, insurers cannot provide that role in a positive way. They do not have the power. They it would be bad for an insurer to be the guy who, to be the insurer with the best diabetes care, because diabetes patients are not profitable. But if you could change the market, really change it, bring everybody into the fold, so you never, and everybody has to be offered the same sort of price, so what we call sort of community rating, guaranteed issue, and a mandate. And suddenly you can imagine a role in which insurers, what we now think of as insurers, begin trying to really figure out what their new core competency should be. And they begin to become essentially disease management or guiding organizations. You know, everybody's got a nurse practitioner who helps them figure things out. And I really actually would like to see innovation in that role. And that's why I say that I think there's a policy argument, because while I think that you could do it in single payer, and in other countries it works just fine, and if you want to give us – I feel like the real liberal conservative compromise on healthcare is we invade France and take their healthcare, and then everybody gets something they want. But in the short term, what I think you should have is a space in which you could actually have sort of real innovation in how people experience their care, how they're guided through it, you know, their ability to get access to information on, you know, which hospitals and which doctors are the best at the treatments they need, are the cheapest at the treatments they need. And I don't trust that individuals on their own are going to be able to force that level of transparency or sort of care quality. I mean, one thing that is true about doctors that worries me sometimes, I mean, you see it in the sort of pay-for-performance debates, doctors have a tendency to think of themselves like Lake Wobegon, like everybody's above average. But no, some doctors, like, aren't that good. And you know, you really do need institutions that aren't tied up in that complex and are able to guide people through it and find some profit there. If that is some sort of government utility, fine. I don't think we're going to have that, and I'd sort of like to see, at least in the short term, try to see if we could have a sort of innovative, dynamic market figuring that one out.
All right.
So that's where I'd come down on it.
Well, I can't say anything negative about doctors without invoking the wrath of my family. I'm enough of a black sheep within it for not being one myself. Let me make the political argument, you know, sort of for the popularity of what you call the McCain / Panuro approach, and then try briefly to make a sort of counter argument to what you were saying on the policy, keeping in mind the probable limits to people's patience on this. First of all, on the politics of it, my read on it is that the anxiety most people have. Most people have about health insurance is they're going to lose their insurance if they switch a job. Their employer is going to give them worse insurance next year, or insurance where they don't have access to the doctor that they want, that sort of thing. And it seems to me that moving towards moving gently towards a more individually purchased marketplace as opposed to employer-provided system will help to alleviate that concern. That is, it's not just a transfer of responsibility, but also a transfer of control and resources, and that's, I think, what makes it politically sellable and what makes it politically possible, that will be experienced by the individual as a grant of a tax credit to them that they didn't have before. I mean, they don't sort of see the employer-provided tax break, whereas they're going to see this individually provided tax break. And yes, we could certainly have all kinds of arguments about the effects of this, but I think just as the first order effect of it is just going to be something that's popular. Yeah, I get a new tax break for health insurance. I think that the arguments against that are going to sound kind of speculative, and also in most cases, you know, you say that people may not be equipped to handle these things. I think a lot of people think they are, whether they are or not. And then let me shift into the policy argument. I think you're absolutely right, Ezra, to suggest that individuals cannot on their own navigate the system, but I would make two points. One, that the complexity of the system is in part a result of the current sort of regulatory apparatus, and that you can envision a less complicated landscape in a more market-based system. For one thing, you probably would not be switching insurance quite as much because you wouldn't be depending on your employer as much. And secondly, I think it's always important in these discussions, whether it's about healthcare or school choice or anything else like this, to remember that in a marketplace with properly designed incentives, intermediary institutions are likely to arise to help people to grant them, you know, to help them navigate these complicated systems. I mean, no market would work if every consumer had to have the same level of expertise about the industry that its actual sort of the providers and participants in that industry had. But markets work tolerably well in a lot of cases because individuals don't need to have that level of expertise, and one of the reasons they don't is that intermediary institutions arise, or the most sophisticated consumers end up setting a tone for others. I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which markets can get past the informational asymmetries.
I feel like I should stop here on a couple things, though. Number one,
sure,
is that the healthcare market is a different market. I mean, doctors are essentially demigods. You're not given a chemotherapy prescription. You say, you know what, I'm going to go on WebMD and really check this. I mean, maybe you do. You check it out. But it's very rare that people feel able to say no to what they're offered or to what they're prescribed. It's not like buying a TV. You know, if you don't buy your TV, you don't die. If you don't take mm-hmm. your statin drug, you may well. And there's just sort of a lot of evidence on this. I mean, even going back to a study about a year or two ago on statin drugs in Medicare, which showed that when you increased cost sharing, fewer people used them, but you didn't save money because more people died. And they went to the hospital. So I think there's that part to it. I think also, I mean, yeah, it's true that if John McCain, sort of existing in a vacuum, came out and said, I'm going to give y'all an awesome tax break for your health care, that would probably be popular.
Right.
But when it comes down, I mean, you saw a really interesting argument between him and Elizabeth Edwards, where she came on and said, you know, John, under your health care plan, I couldn't go onto the market and get health care. And more to the point, you couldn't go onto the market and get health care. And she was correct. I mean, there's nothing in there that says insurers cannot discriminate on conditions anymore. There's
right.
nothing in there that protects the people who are currently disadvantaged in the system. And I think it'll sound really tinny, by the way, coming from McCain, who was on naval health care until he was 18, then joined the Navy, then joined right after he got back from Vietnam, and so he was on naval health care till then. Then right when he got back from Vietnam, joined Congress, became part of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program until he was 65 and he went on to Medicare. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really going to look bad. And the reason is not because, hey, I can take this cheap shot at John. He's been on government-provided health insurance his whole life. It's that what his system does explicitly, I mean, what all of them do, and it's not going to be hard. The quotes are in his speeches. It's not like I have to dig around for him. Is saying, you know, we should go towards HSAs, we should go towards more money up front, towards skin in the game,
yeah.
the whole deal. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's going to be a little bit weird when you go to people and you say, what we think you need is less health care. And it's not going to be a lie to say that about that plan. It's literally the argument that people currently consume too much health care because they're not price sensitive enough. And I think what people feel, I mean, I would like to see people consume less health care also. I think mm-hmm. that we'd be better off having those decisions, pushed by sort of a comparative effectiveness review that did better. You know, I don't know that people are going to know which healthcare to cut back on their own, but I think it's going to be a really hard. It has always struck me, HSAs, by the way. I'll put it this way and end it here, I guess, that they're the logical extension of the current healthcare marketplace. They're healthcare for people who don't need healthcare, and I think that so much of the psychology of the healthcare issue is people either, and the politics of it, is people who do need health care, and people, when they think about it, don't think about themselves now. They think about, how will it be when I need health care? And when they hear $10,000 maximum deductible, that doesn't look good. Very few people have that, or not very few, but a lot of people don't have that laying around in the bank
right.
the day they get cancer. And so I think that it's got to be thought of more holistically than McCain is going to give you a tax credit, because it's not going to be presented that way. It's going to be presented as, what does this do to you trying to get health when you are sick? And what it does there is a very different take on how healthcare should work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. I'll let that be the last word and move on. Although you and I can probably continue this conversation for.
Oh no, you deserve a rebuttal. I meant I would just end my comment there, and then I mean if you wanna, you should talk back to it, and then we can go to.
All right. Well, first of all,
I feel like you deserve a rebuttal.
Look. Again, we have to. All right. First, on the policy point, yeah, I think that the pre-existing conditions thing is probably the most serious vulnerability that the McCain plan has, but I think it's limited in that, first of all, you say, well, insurers are free to reject people based on pre-existing conditions already, so you know my plan doesn't sort of give them this new power, and I understand there's a response to that, but I mean, I think he's, you know, sort of, that can sort of get him through the debate, partly. And secondly, it's a small subsection of the population compared to all the number of people who are going to have more control, a new tax break, and so on. It's true, as you say, that you know the Democratic opponents are going to be able to are going to say all kinds of things about how it shifts risks and so on and so forth. And you're right that there's perfectly reasonable people are going to be making these arguments. I mean, I think the arguments you make are perfectly reasonable. I don't agree with them for various reasons. But all I'm saying is there are also going to be, in my view, perfectly reasonable and, in fact, better arguments on the other side. And I think for most people it's going to be a wash. And what they're going to come out with is, okay, so, yeah, I'd like that tax credit. You know, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, people like you are going to make a big, big effort to try to convince people that that this plan's effects will be really bad for them when they're looking for health care. I just think, number one, it's going to be a little bit of a wash. It's going to be over people's heads. Secondly, remember that Republicans don't actually have to win the argument on health care. They just have to cut their losses on it because it's been a traditional huge Democratic advantage. So anyway, with that, maybe we should move on to something else.
I look forward to it. onto the only thing more interesting than healthcare, tax reform.
Yeah, right, right. Let me, if I could talk a little bit about that, because Ezra and I have actually had various sort of blog exchanges and actually magazine article exchanges about this. A couple years ago, I wrote up the idea of a tax reform proposal that, in a very sort of modest way, achieves a lot of the traditional supply-side Republican goals of keeping the capital gains tax and the estate tax and dividend tax permanently low, but also expands the child tax credit and shifts the burden of taxation upward. The idea would be that there'd be a very modest reduction in marginal tax rates for people at the top end of the income scale, but that their average taxes would go up. The total amount of money they'd be paying would go up. The progressivity would be achieved basically in a large part by having large personal exemption and large child credits. And, I sort of made a policy argument for this and a political argument for this. And one of the things I suggested was that since liberals tend to object mostly to things like a dividend tax cut on distributional grounds, if it's wrapped up in an overall tax reform that shifts the burden of taxation upward on the income scale, you might be able to get some sort of bipartisan support and some kind of liberal support. And I said, you know, some conservatives would object to that kind of distributional impact because they think it was too progressive. But that, you know, in my view, that would be a mistake. You'd be giving up too much. And anyway, you wrote about this and you said, you know, having looked at this proposal, I can't imagine why anybody would consider it to be too progressive. But that was in the context of an article where you were talking about a lot of other things. And so you didn't sort of go on and explain yourself. But I mean, just given the way I've just described it, does that sound objectionable to you, or does it sound like something that, under certain circumstances, you might be willing to support?
The first question that has to be asked, right, is it revenue neutral? Does it raise revenue? Does it take it down?
The proposal as outlined is revenue neutral, but I would be more concerned about keeping that structure. If it was decided that you needed a tax system that needed to raise more money, then I would say, you know, raise some of those rates, but keep the basic structure of a large child credit, lower taxes on capital dividends and so forth, and ordinary income. And
who pays more now? It's people at the top of the distribution?
Yeah, people at the top of the distribution would, particularly those who have no children, would pay more.
I mean, look, I'm not going to really offer a lot of comment because, as I said before we started, I just don't, I've looked at it then and don't remember all the details.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to ambush you with it.
In the theory of it, I think the fights will have are a couple. And I don't think, let's put it this way, I think this is less objectionable than a lot of things I hear.
Okay. Well, that's progress.
What I think is that I would not, I mean, you basically, I think, are going to take out the estate tax over the dead body of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I think the estate tax is just about the most sensible and worthwhile tax we have going today. And I don't think that's going to go down so people at the top can have an easier go in the marginal rates. Number two, I think that, you know, this gets into a more interesting sort of philosophical debate, which was what I was writing about in that article, which was, should the point of social policy be to, as I think the Republican Party may, at least in certain intellectual sectors, be moving towards, should it be to advantage a nuclear family? So rather than a sort of situation in which people feel the Democrats want to help out the poor and the Republicans want to help out the rich, you have a sort of a meeting where the Democrats want to help out the poor and the Republicans want to help out the nuclear family.
Right.
I actually think of that as a much more productive argument. I'm not sure I agree with – I don't really agree with the Republican side. I want more sort of straight redistribution that people can decide if they want to have kids or not. But I do think that is a less objectionable argument to me than the sort of Larry Kudlow style, you know, what we really, really need to do is make sure stockbrokers get even richer. And so I actually do see – let's put it this way. I support your plan in context of inter-Republican warfare.
I see. Right. Well
– go on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't really – no, I mean, I see your – I mean, look, I mean, one of the reasons I support this is I do think that the political context would be much more favorable than the one you outlined. You know, as a sort of pro-family as opposed to pro-rich kind of position. I don't really regard it myself. I have this fight with libertarians a lot. Well, not all libertarians, but some libertarians make this a very similar argument, which is you're sort of subsidizing childbearing, you're subsidizing the nuclear family. Well, and to which my response would be, actually, it's not really particularly subsidizing the nuclear family in a way that single mothers would be eligible for this benefit as well, which then gets me into trouble with the social right. But second, I mean, my whole argument is that the burden of payroll taxes is so hard on young families that in a way this is sort of evening the scales more than it is subsidizing them. And there's, in fact, you know, there's a more complicated argument about how the way our entitlements are structured ends up being a kind of implicit tax on raising children because, you know, the contribution you're making to the entitlements you make that contribution both by paying taxes, but you also make that contribution by raising kids, and the system ought to make an allowance for that fact.
Mm-hmm.
That's my answer to libertarians, is that, you know, I'm not actually subsidizing children. I'm just sort of evening the playing field, because even if you're sort of a straight libertarian analyst, you have to regard this as, you know, whether for good or ill, and I think partly for good and partly for ill, we have socialized the returns on having kids, right? I mean, the old days, people depended on having their own kids to take care of them in their old age, and we haven't really gotten rid of that generational dynamic. We've merely collectivized it, where everybody depends on the next generation, But the problem is you have a free rider problem. You have a classic free rider problem. Whereas if you don't have kids, you're relying on other people having made that financial sacrifice, raising the kids who will then provide for you during your retirement.
I think that's an interesting point. I mean, and I'll say a sort of larger thing, because I don't feel super qualified to comment until I've read everything in detail, is that I do think Democrats are really, really absent on this issue. I think that Democrats have essentially bought into two Republican frames on tax reform. One is that taxes are too complex, and two is that it's better if they're lower. And they've modified the second frame by saying it's better if they're lower on the poor and higher on the rich. So tax cuts become tax fairness in that model, but essentially they are argued on the same grounds of lower for the majority of you. And I think it's a real shame in a way. I mean, I didn't support the flat tax, the sort of magic Mike Huckabee thing that was based on like all sorts of faulty accounting, but I did like seeing this sort of thing reconceptualized and thought through as an element of social policy. What can you do with it? What is the best way to approach this? And I like seeing what you're doing with this, and I really do wish that, you know, I think the tax plans of Clinton and Obama and Edwards have been very disappointing, very disappointing. Yeah. I think that...
And I would say that Ron I would Wyden, say the same thing for McCain, disappointing tax plan.
Ron Wyden, I think, has a sort of interesting fair flat tax. It has a sort of work wealth equalizing, making capital gains equal to income taxes, which I think is useful. But more to the point, I just would like to see Democrats and liberals think a little bit harder about, okay, you know, what sort of tax system should we have? I think Robert Frank has a proposal for a progressive consumption tax, which I think is very interesting. And sort of the effects of making a progressive consumption tax, it would sort of disincentivize this sort of really intense, conspicuous consumption at the high ends of the spectrum. It would sort of encourage people to save, which in the end gives them more money. I mean, it would do a couple things that I think liberals should see as a real social good. And then, you know, others have a transaction tax that floats around Congress every so often. I think that's an interesting idea. I would really like to see healthcare funded through dedicated taxation. Mainly, I support a VAT of that tax for it, which is a type of sales tax. I think the Democrats also are very bad at talking about taxation. They talk about it in a – I would only argue for dedicated taxes, which have their sort of policy problems. But I think Democrats tell you to give money to the government instead of telling you to buy things as a society.
Yeah.
And I think that you're on much stronger political ground when you're saying, you know what, this is a good deal. Paying X amount for health care, you pay Y amount in premiums, this will be lower, you'll get better health care, than being in a sort of vacuum, it would be great if we could raise the tax rate from 38% to 41%.
Yeah.
Okay, but why? Just so the government gets more money? Well, where's it going? I think that it is an interesting thing to me that after all these years of getting bopped on the head by taxes, the Democrats sort of haven't come up with a more sophisticated or aggressive take on them.
They could be driving the train. They could be driving the train next year. You don't have a great sense that they know where they want to go.
I agree.
On tax policy. You know, first of all, I mean, I think actually under certain circumstances, I'd support a progressive consumption tax as well, so this could be an area of convergence. But actually, what you said sort of reminded me of something...
Among liberal and conservative writers?
Yeah, right. exactly.
The key constituency.
That's something you said reminded me of something we were saying a while ago when you're talking about sort of the George Packer discussion being a little too sort of focused on intellectuals and not on sort of anything going on outside of our heads. And it reminds me of something, actually, Ed Kilgore from the DLC told me years ago about how everybody misunderstood the Clinton campaign of 1992, because it wasn't so much just a matter of the Clintons sort of throwing overboard the party base and appealing to the center, but there were all of these things where the party elites weren't even in step with the base of the party, where, you know, in fact, the base of the party was perfectly happy about the idea of welfare reform. It pulled quite well, Clinton-style welfare reform pulled quite well among actual Democratic voters. And it seems to me what separates the sort of stuff that Ross Douthat and Ryan Salaam and to a lesser extent myself are trying to do is I mean, when you talk about sort of like reorienting tax policy towards being pro-family rather than a pro-rich policy, it seems to me that that actually would be less controversial among rank-and-file conservative voters or among the Republican Party voters than it would be among conservative elites, among party elites. And that, I think, is what makes, what creates an actual political potential for what would otherwise be sort of eerie theorizing, because we don't have to sort of say, well, wouldn't we be great if we had voters, you know, who might be interested in this, you know, or wouldn't it be great if we sort of could create this whole new coalition? I mean, if you could get the sort of thinkers in the party reoriented, I think you could actually have a pretty big effect on the party as a whole. But that wouldn't be true for any set of ideas. I think it is true for this particular set of ideas.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that's right, and I think it's not a bad place to end. I wish you luck in pulling your party back from the plutocratic brink.
Well, if not in beating your party good and hard, yeah. All right. Well, very nice talking to you. The first time we've actually spoken to each other. As opposed to have blog exchanges, and hopefully we'll do it again.
All right.
Take care.
Take it easy. Have a good Memorial Day.
Ah, excellent.